Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
It is Monday, August 4th. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
Triple welcome.
Yep, it's back.
I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt, folks.
So today we are popping the hood on artificial intelligence. We're going to take a look at what it takes to make AI work. Believe it or not, it's a lot more than just a few clever engineers or smart machines. Instead, it is electricity, it is power, and it's lots and lots of it. So much, in fact, that a single AI data center could use more power than the entire city of Philadelphia. It's huge, 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 huge power suck. So on the show today, we'll look at how the AI boom is reshaping land use, utility grids, also some of the politics of it all. And why are we talking about this? Well, it's coming to Pennsylvania. It's coming to Delaware. Could come to New Jersey, right? But we haven't figured out yet whether it'll be a blessing, bringing investment, jobs, and growth opportunities, or a burden, harming the environment and driving up our electric bills. So we have two guests that'll help us better understand what is heading our way. And we want to invite you to participate in the conversation. Our questions of the day are this: what concerns do you have about AI data centers coming to Pennsylvania or Delaware, if you're living down there? And what questions do you think government should be asking before we welcome big tech in? You can call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, hello. Put those comments, put those questions in the live chat.
Great setup. I didn't like the way you threw in or Delaware, sort of as an afterthought in there. Delaware folks, you are equally,
yes,
are equally welcome to come on the
and
show.
Jersey
today.
Too. Yeah. Whatever. Jersey too. What questions you had?
Pennsylvania, Delaware, Jersey, all equal.
All
welcome to call. No, this is a huge issue.
Yes.
And I'm so happy we're doing this show. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Of course, YouTube, drop a comment right there in the chat. First, Cherry.
Trio of news stories.
Okay. I wasn't expecting that. So the first story, you might have already heard about this, but the school district of Philadelphia has begun a process to ultimately close some of its schools. The Inquirer released an article today looking at some of the data the district might use to determine which schools it will close. And they found about a third of the district's school buildings operate at 50% capacity or lower, meaning they're half empty. Overall, the district's buildings can hold about 187,000 students, but there are just 118,000 students attending. The last big school closing wave, because you might remember this topic, it was 2012-2013, about 30 school district buildings closed.
Wow.
And it looks like they're gearing up for another round of closures.
Yeah, I mean, it was so interesting to me. I mean, of the 68 schools that are at least half empty, 16 also ranked poor or unsatisfactory for their program alignment, and their building scores were also low. And what also stood out to me was that there are 25 schools, mostly in the Northeast, that are over capacity.
Yeah.
And while most of them have decent buildings, some of them are even excellent, there are schools in this category, like Masterman, that have poor ratings when it comes to the actual building itself. So there's just a lot of work that
Masterman,
school district,
for the folks who don't know, is a highly touted magnet school in Center City.
So. And people love that school. They talk about, you know, just the high level of performance there. So I just feel like the district has a lot of work ahead of it. And we know that, you know, closing a school could have a significant ripple effect on the community, especially a fragile community.
Yeah. And the students. And the last time that the district went through this process, there were demonstrably poor effects, academic effects on students, not to mention the emotional effects. And the cost savings were not as great as anticipated. And so there clearly needs to be lessons learned before they embark on this process again. That said, big picture perspective, the school district of Philadelphia has shrunk dramatically for several reasons, one of which is the rise of charter schools and other types of school choice. The other is just city of Philadelphia just used to be a lot bigger. And so there is a capacity mismatch, to put it in gobbledygook language. There's just too much space for the number of students that there are. And there are costs to operating buildings that are half empty. This is a difficult process. I assume it will be difficult moving forward. But
you hope there's transparency.
You hope there's and you just hope it goes a little better than last time. I think the overall takeaway from last time was it just wasn't as good a process as it could have been.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Yeah. Story number two, the Lansdowne Theater in Delaware County is set to reopen later this month. And it is slated to host its first live performance since the 1980s.
Dang.
Yeah. Been a long time. Really cool story on PhillyVoice.com about the $21 million renovation of the Lansdowne Theater. It has restored the original features from the 1920s, including chandelier arrangements, tile work, and paintings. The 1,200-plus theater originally opened in 1927. It was a movie house and had that old-style opulent feel, right? That it felt like you were going to a night out. But it shut down in 1987 after an electrical fire. But it still was pretty famous. If you remember Silver Linings Playbook, right, with Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, it served as the backdrop to that 2012 movie.
I did not remember that, but thank you for reminding
me.
It's right there.
Yeah, it's right. But what's so interesting to me about this story is that this restoration uses a model that we've seen in other century plus old theaters in our region. A nonprofit takes over, it raises money to restore it, and then it comes up with a new business model, you know, to keep the theater alive. And you think about Newtown Theater in Bucks County, where we had, it's the country's oldest continuously operating movie theater. And it reopened after a renovation in 2021. We had our holiday movie extravaganza.
Yeah, self-promotion, there, baby. Yeah, here we there. Go.
And it was such a beautiful theater. And they found a new life for it. I mean, they have movie clubs. They have tribute bands. And that's kind of what they're going to do at the Lansdowne once it reopens on August 22nd.
That sounds great. I love an old, I don't even like going to the theater that much, but I do just love looking at an old theater. I would walk through you don't have to show anything.
Yeah.
I'll just walk around. I would pay $2 just to walk around.
Yeah, just to walk. And they've added new plush seats.
Ooh.
You know, they did do some new things.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it still has that feel.
Yeah.
You know, that
it's got the old feel, but it's got some conveniences for the modern butt. Mm-hmm. I like that.
The modern butt. You definitely got to. That is so funny. That's a good.
I love it. By the way, I looked back to see what they played the first night it opened.
Ooh.
The Lansdowne Theater. Mm-hmm. According to the newspaper, The Inquirer, the first show was called Knockout Riley.
I've never heard of that.
It's like an old silent movie about a boxer. And then they also showed a newsreel of Charles Lindbergh's arrival in Paris after he made his famous transatlantic flight. So there you go.
Wow. That's kind of cool. You always put little nuggets in there. That's how old it is.
It's really, really old.
And it's coming back.
Yeah,
some new stuff.
The big A word then was aviation, not AI. It was a long time ago.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So story number three, Cherry.
All right.
And story number three, as always, is an important one.
Mm-hmm. Hint.
On Friday, a truckload of hot dogs spilled across a highway in York County, Pennsylvania, which understandably unleashed a wave of news coverage and hot dog related wordplay.
Mm-hmm.
This comes just weeks, by the way, after a dump truck spilled 20,000 eggs in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And earlier in July, a section of I-80 in Center County had to be closed because hundreds of boxes of mozzarella cheese tumbled onto the highway. So full breakfast has just spilled over the last month or so in Pennsylvania. I don't know what's going on, but I'm sure you have thoughts because you knew we were going to talk about this. So, here you go.
Yeah. it's so interesting how so many strange things end up on our roadways.
Isn't it so interesting?
Yeah. And I zoomed out.
Research?
Did a little bit of research. You mentioned that cheese. In that same crash, which involved three, trucks, by the way, there was also hand sanitation wipes.
Mm.
Could have helped. I don't know if that helps with the cheese or what, but that was in there.
Yeah.
And if you zoom out even more to Los Angeles in 2014, thousands of oranges spilled on the highway. A year later in North Carolina, hundreds and hundreds of boxes of ramen noodles.
Okay.
College kid's dream right there.
What's your big takeaway from all this?
There's all kinds of stuff in these trucks, man.
There's all kinds of stuff in these trucks. You heard it here, folks.
And by the way, 2015, yeah. Ohio, 2,200 baby pigs running around.
Oh, gosh. That's kind of sad.
That's real life.
But by the way, we just say no human beings were harmed in these crashes, thankfully.
No.
Car crashes are serious news, and they're bad, and we should do more to prevent them. But it is a strange thing. Also, watermelon truck spill, Salem County, New Jersey, 2016.
Watermelon.
45,000 pounds of unstamped pennies, I-95, Delaware, 2016. 2015, 80,000 pounds of apple juice spilled out of a truck in Burlington County, New Jersey.
I wonder what that smelled like after a couple of days. Like, well, the worst one's definitely a vinegary smell.
Yeah, I think the eggs is probably the worst. 20,000 eggs, that's on a hot July day.
You think the egg will start frying on the pavement?
Speaking of frying, our electric grid... Data centers, they're coming to Pennsylvania, Delaware, maybe New Jersey as well. They are a huge energy suck, but a lot of people think they're necessary to maintain America's competitiveness in the world economically. We're going to talk about them on the other side of this break. You're listening to Studio 2.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The data center building boom is big. How big is it? Well, according to a story this morning in the Washington Post, big tech companies are pouring so much money into data centers, they may literally be propping up the entire American economy.
Now, these drab-looking buildings are popping up in cornfields and industrial parks across the country. Pennsylvania officials clearly want them. Within the last couple of months, state leaders announced over $100 billion in data center-related investment.
And that money is tantalizing for a post-industrial state like Pennsylvania. It's also risky. Data centers require tons of energy, enough to drive up your electricity bill. And there's concern this building frenzy will come at a steep environmental cost.
So how enthused or worried should we be? To help us navigate that question, we've invited Cade Metz, technology correspondent with The New York Times. Cade, welcome and thanks for being here.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
We also have in studio Benjamin Lee, professor of electrical and systems engineering at the University of Pennsylvania. Ben, welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
And for our listeners at home, what concerns do you have about AI data centers coming to PA? What questions do you think the government should be asking before welcoming big tech? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org if you're on YouTube. Great to have you. Drop a comment in the chat.
And before we discuss whether they should be built, we have to understand what they are. And so, Cade, for folks who've never seen a data center, I want you to help paint a picture. What are we talking about here? What's inside these humongous buildings?
Well, if you've used the internet, which we all have, you've used a data center, right? When you make a search on Google, when you visit Amazon to buy something, you're calling a computer across the internet that is housed in a data center operated by one of these giant tech companies. And these data centers, built by companies like Amazon and Google, have been around for decades. These companies are built on these giant football stadium sized computing centers. But what we're seeing now is an increase in the amount of computing power, the amount of electricity that are going into these things. These are pretty drab buildings. If you've seen one data center, you've seen them all. It's rows and rows of computers. You've seen them all until you go to, say, Indiana, where I went this summer and lay your eyes on the new Amazon data center there, for instance. And then you're blown away by the size of it. And we'll go into that. The message here is that these very drab football stadium sized data centers are getting bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where we're talking about 8, 10, 30 football stadium-sized data centers in one place.
Wow.
Okay, so
that's huge. Yeah.
What's so fascinating about all of this to me, Ben, is that these data centers have been around for a while, and over that period of time, we were becoming more and more reliant on our computers. But overall, it seems like energy consumption in America was actually pretty stable. So whatever these data centers were doing, they weren't drawing up enough power to like influence the big picture of how much electricity our country needs to run. And then something changed. What changed?
Right. So the focus on artificial intelligence, first with the advent of training these massive models that can respond to queries and natural language prompts, that was a big sea change. Now we needed these systems that could process massive amounts of data and also churn for weeks or months on end in coordination. You might have 100,000 of these chips in a coordinated fashion, learning what the next language model might need to do or might need to respond to. So that was a huge change. And that changed what goes into the data center. We went from central processing units, the types that we have in our laptops.
That's the type of chip.
Right. So these chips have been sitting in our laptops and our tablets and our phones for years, for decades. But now we're talking about GPUs, these really capable chips that are great at the maths required for AI, and they draw a lot more power, not only when we use them to train these really advanced models, but also when we start using these advanced models, when we start asking these models to do things for us, we're turning to these same chips that draw a lot of power. So collectively, the training of these models, but also the use of these models are driving those power costs up by order of magnitude, 10x, maybe even 100x.
Wow. And when I think about it, because, you know, I read that, you know, nationwide, the electricity costs have gone up about 4.4%. I know in Philadelphia, it's about $17 a month that we pay more now. And I wonder why is this, why not, you know, just charge the data centers, Cade? Like, why is it that all of us will see these increased costs? How does this work? And why is it a shared expense?
Well, the first thing to realize is that these data centers need so much electrical power that the electrical grid as it stands today cannot serve them. Okay, what that means is we have to find additional sources of power, or governments and these large tech companies and power companies have to build additional sources of power. In some cases, the plan is to tap into nuclear power plants that have long been dormant. In other cases, it's build wind farms, but predominantly right now, because these companies are moving so quickly, it's natural gas. That's the quickest way to aggregate more power, feed it into these data centers. As you build more infrastructure, you've got to pay for it. These big companies will say, we're going to pay for it, but they're getting tax breaks from local governments. In some cases, it's the consumer who's going to pay as that grid is expanded. So it's going to be different in different places, but that is certainly a risk that you and I will end up paying as these large tech companies build these data centers. Wow.
To illustrate your point, there is a town in Western Pennsylvania called Homer City, where there used to be a coal-fired power plant. That's now being transformed into a gigantic gas-powered, natural gas-powered data center. So just one example of what Cade is laying out. Julia sends us an interesting email. Julia says, when did any of us agree to this? We're already facing an environmental catastrophe. I'm not a fan of AI or the technology that's been pushed on us since the iPhone. These systems are not going to help us solve our actual problems and do not help us connect across our humanity. I feel like this is in the interest of the tech billionaires who will get rich off this new technology. So what is the argument, Cade, that the big tech companies are making as for why we need to do all of this so quickly?
Well, the argument is wide, and the ideas are myriad, but basically, you know, they're saying that this is going to accelerate the economy. It's going to accelerate the work that so much of us do, beginning with computer programmers. It's going to allow them to write computer code and build applications quicker. It's going to allow people to, in a business setting, write official documents, legal documents, et cetera, at a faster rate. And if you accelerate people's work, then in the end, you make more money. They're even making even larger claims about these models eventually curing cancer. and helping to accelerate drug discovery. That sort of thing is still very much in the future. And what we have today is a system, you know, something like ChatGPT and the technology behind it that can accelerate programming. It can help you write documents, but it's yet to be seen how much that will really change the economy. And the other thing to remember, and we'll get into this, is just how expensive is just to serve up these applications. And it's unclear if they can get the price down to make this a really viable thing for businesses and individuals. But they're promising a lot that's still in the future. In the meantime, they're all in a race, right? It's like FOMO.
That's what I was going to ask about, Kate. Yeah. They must be also considering the price of not doing it, the opportunity cost. And I don't know if, Ben, you have some takes on that. A lot of our commenters are very skeptical, and I want to get to their skepticism. But first, I want to understand why this investment is happening to maybe provide a little counterbalance. So clearly, they're worried, I would think, that if they don't do this, that they'll be missing out on some sort of big opportunity. Can you elaborate on that?
Right. And just to build on that, the fear of missing out is pervasive in big tech right now. Yeah. We see these transitions happen periodically in tech where the dominant player like Microsoft goes through this phase where they have to reinvent themselves. And now they're coming back out with their partnership with OpenAI and other models. So this constant reinvention, this disruptive reinvention is driving a lot of this capital investment in capital infrastructure. So that's within the United States. And then, of course, geopolitically, we see this discussion about the fear of missing out, the fear of losing dominance in energy and in AI and in technology. And that's driving a lot of the discussions both within the United States and abroad. And I think the potential benefits are out into the future. This moment reminds me of when I started studying computing at the dawn of the internet, right? Mm. So we saw this massive investment in the internet, in networking infrastructure and so on. And we didn't really see the immediate benefits. People were creating these random web pages for pets.com or whatever. But nowadays, we realize that the internet has fundamentally changed the way we live and the way we work. But it took 10, 15 years for the advent of the internet to Google and Meta.
So that's the time horizon these guys are thinking along potentially.
Right. So building out the platforms, building out the infrastructure so that you're ready for those, what we call killer apps, those dominant applications, those dominant use cases. The reason why there is, I think, a lot of skepticism, rightly, from some of these people in the audience is that we don't know what those outcomes will be. We're still very much in the exploratory phase. And that's why you see all these companies investing massively. They don't know yet what it will be useful for. Right now, it's augmenting search engines, but it could be something much bigger than that, curing cancer. Until we figure that out, we've got to explore, we've got to invest. The last thing I'll say here is that if you've got this vision for an AI model that you want to build and you're not quite getting the answer you're hoping for, you're not quite getting the capability you're hoping for, you don't want to wonder, oh, if I just built another data center, if I just spent another 1 gigawatt of power, I would have gone there.
The gold is always around the next bend in the road, right?
So we don't know, right?
Yeah. And Kate, I want to ask you sort of, because you alluded to this and we talked about, you know, $100 billion investment in Pennsylvania, potentially. How much does all of this cost? Can we even wrap our head around what the expense will be to build this infrastructure for what we don't necessarily know yet is out ahead of us?
Yeah, it's hard. The numbers are so big, it's hard for people to understand what's happening. But, you know, just a few years ago, a $1 billion data center was enormous. Now we're talking $100 billion. These numbers are astounding. And, you know, the other thing to think about, and this ties into the FOMO discussion, is that for these companies, even that money, though, is a drop in the bucket for them, right? These are the biggest companies on earth, and they have lots of available cash. And they're looking towards the future. In this weird way, it kind of makes sense for them to spend this money. And they are certainly going to spend it. They're all worried not only about catching the wave of the future, But in being, you know, in Silicon Valley terminology, disrupted, right? The Google's the prime example of this, where they have this dominant search engine. It makes an enormous amount of money, but now you've got this technology, a chatbot, which can replace the classic search engine in a way. So they're going to spend this money to keep up with the Joneses.
Yeah.
And we can go into the specifics of why this costs so much. A lot of it is about size, but the basic infrastructure inside these data centers is changing. And Ben alluded to this. It's a new type of chip. It uses more electricity. That means it gets hotter. Mm-hmm. And it gets hotter, you need new ways of
cooling it down.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And I wonder sort of, because before we get into, you know, some of the environmental impacts and all the things that when you talk about the heat that these places generate, sort of what makes a place attractive for one of these data centers? I mean, Pennsylvania is on the list of places. We raised our hand to bring those centers in. So what makes a place like Pennsylvania attractive to these companies as a place to build a data center, as one of these massive, massive centers?
Well, you need three things, basically. You need land, and you need electrical power, and nowadays you need water. And the way these things are cooled down is different, and in many cases, it requires lots of water. A fourth thing you might say, though, is you need a tax break.
Yeah.
And so these companies are going to the places that are welcoming them and promising them the tax break and allowing them to move forward at a rapid rate.
That part I kind of don't get, Cade, because it seems like on some level these companies are boxed in. They feel a intense urge to build really quickly. They need a lot of electricity. It's really not available in many places. So there's only certain places it seems like they can build. And so why am I, as a locality, incentivizing them? It just feels like they don't have a ton of options. You need the electricity. You need the water. You need the space. How many people can even offer that? I mean, Philadelphia, I would imagine, couldn't even offer those things. So there's a lot of places that already are sort of out of the running. Cade, real quick, why are the tax breaks on the table?
Well, there are some big forces here. I mean, if you're Pennsylvania, if you're Indiana, you know, you want investment in your state, you want to grow your economy, and this is the one way to do it, right? As other parts of industry decline, as you know, even, you know, farmland, as I saw in Indiana, becomes less valuable, you want to repurpose that and bring money into your state. Now, we'll see how this really affects the economies of these states and whether or not it does create jobs, because typically data centers have created jobs temporarily, but yep, not in the long term. You don't need a lot of people to run these.
Yeah, things. I was wondering, like, what humans are actually in there? Yeah.
And on that note, I just want to bring this up because Governor Josh Shapiro here in Pennsylvania announced this $20 billion investment by Amazon in a pair of facilities, one of which is going to be in Bucks County. And the official estimate was about 1,200 jobs between the two data centers. The one in Bucks County is going to be built on the site of a steel mill that once employed 9,000 people. So that's way fewer jobs for that same land use. Give me a sense, Ben, of who would work at a data center, how much money they would make, and how long those jobs would last.
Right. And I think the nature of jobs is really the driving force, and it's bipartisan. We see discussion across the spectrum about the number of jobs. I was a few weeks ago at CMU, the Carnegie Mellon University, at this AI summit, right, where President Trump attended, Senator McCormick organized it, plenty of cabinet secretaries were there, Josh Shapiro was there, the governor, and all of them were talking about, we need 500,000 new electricians trained up. And this could be an opportunity for electricians to get that training and also to have good paying jobs without the university degree. There's also a lot of discussion about construction jobs. There's a lot of discussion about technical work related to the hardware. So maybe as hardware goes into the data center and as it comes back out again, there might be work in terms of refurbishing or extracting the components. And so there are a variety of jobs associated with it. But the actual day-to-day running, as Kate mentioned, as the day-to-day running of the data center is highly automated, sophisticated software infrastructure. So really, the day-to-day, you really only need people to go into the data center when a component has failed. You need to swap it out, put in a new component back in. With a system that big, those failures will happen often. So you do have people going into the data center, but we're not talking about 9,000 jobs to replace.
Not like an assembly line.
No, definitely not. Yeah. Definitely not.
And I wonder, like, if you think about, 1,200 jobs coming, I do wonder how many jobs will be lost because of AI. Like, there's a lot of jobs that the AI that you're actually now building will replace. Is that not correct, Cade? I mean, have you seen this sort of happen in other cities that have built these centers, and maybe there have been this sort of shift and reconfiguration of how people work and who has a job versus who doesn't?
It's something we definitely have to think about long term. Some jobs will go away, and some already are, in a way. These systems still require a human being, though. Let's not forget that, right? Someone has to type something into ChatGPT to get an answer. If you're a programmer, you have to think about the bigger picture of your program. When these systems generate computer code and make a mistake, you've got to recognize the mistake. And the same goes for all sorts of other applications. These things make mistakes. Scientists call that hallucination in these systems. And you need a person in the mix, certainly today and for the foreseeable future. But what happens potentially is that people at the low end end up being replaced. That if you can generate the computer code that a junior programmer used to do, those sorts of jobs are in danger. And you're going to see a shift. As we've seen for hundreds of years with new technology, some jobs go away, but others are created. But there's this huge debate now over what the ratio will be. And some people insist that this technology is different than any other that's come before and will replace far more jobs far more quickly. But that's yet to be seen. Yeah. And the debate will go on for a while.
Yeah. David on YouTube says, maybe data centers can be built below ground. They'll stay cooler. 40% of the power is for cooling the servers. On that note, are we sort of in an archaic state? Like, I'm thinking now right now, Ben, about how we today would view something like the ENIAC. Like, a computer takes up a whole building? That's crazy. Someday down the road, will the technology get better so that the footprint of these is smaller and the energy cost is smaller? Maybe that's building them under the ground. Maybe that's not a CPU, a GPU, but an XPU, some other type of chip. I mean, are we on that progression, or is this kind of going to be the state of play for a while?
That's a great question. And unfortunately, I think we may be in this state of play for a while. Not to get too technical, ever since the 60s, computing has benefited from Moore's law, right? The technology scaling, transistors getting smaller, using less power, so we could build chips that did more with less power. For deeply technical reasons, Moore's law, that shrinking of the transistor and also the power reductions of the power that they're using, that's not playing out anymore. It's stalling out. So as a result, you can double the performance of your system, double the performance of your chip, but you may end up building bigger chips, building bigger systems. So this is really incredibly unfortunate, because we had this really sharp scaling trajectory for the underlying technology, but that stopped. And we're seeing exponential demand for computing, just as
we
that
need
trend
lots of computing
stopped.
Power, but we have not managed to make these things smaller and smaller and more efficient as we were in prior decades.
Exactly. I think there are plenty of efficiency optimizations we can talk about a little bit later, but I think from the chip perspective, from the physical chip design perspective, we're running into pretty significant limits.
Yeah. Mm. on the other side, we're about to go to a break, but I definitely want to get into the environmental concerns. Like, we've talked about the need for water. We've talked about how hot these data centers get. What is the impact on the surrounding communities? What's the impact on climate change? We'll have to talk about that. And we got to have a couple callers on the line. We'll get to you on the other side of the break. And our question of the day is this: what concerns do you have about AI data centers coming to Pennsylvania? And what questions do you think the government should be asking before we welcome in big tech? Our number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And thanks to everybody on YouTube. Keep those questions and comments coming in the live chat. We will be right back. This is Studio 2.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We've been talking about the rush to build AI data centers in our region to power things like ChatGPT and other artificial intelligence applications that companies and consumers use. AI takes enormous amounts of energy to run, and these centers are putting more strain on our power grids and on the environment. And with us today to help us parse through it all, we have Benjamin Lee, professor of electrical and systems engineering at the University of Pennsylvania, in studio. We also have Kate Metz, technology correspondent with the New York Times.
Please, you at home, join the conversation. What concerns do you have about AI data centers coming to Pennsylvania? What questions do you think government should be asking before welcoming big tech? Call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube, drop a comment in the chat. Let's bring in Julie now from Grad Hospital here in Philly. Julie's on line two. Julie, line two, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thanks so much for this topic. I'm really concerned. I think as people, we are stakeholders, and who is deciding this for us? Corporations are going to make a lot of money off of this, but what we have seen is we've seen natural gas companies screw over communities left and right, pollute water. Who's protecting us? We're going to feel the pain of this. And we already have so much environmental catastrophe taking place. We have we have floods, we can't use the energy. We need to protect everybody, and we have to look at the fact, that we are facing.
Yeah.
We don't have, so in other words, I just the arms race thing. I mean, we had a nuclear arms race. That has not benefited us. We don't need the competition part of this feels ridiculous. It's not good for people.
Thank you, Julie
from Grad Hospital here in Philadelphia. And so that goes to the environmental questions that we kind of teed up on the other side of this, Kate. I mean, these data centers are changing the way we use energy, the way we use water. Can you sort of talk about in the sense that as we try to understand how these centers work, how do they impact the environment and bring it all in so we can kind of understand what are the tentacles of impacts that surround these centers?
Yeah, I think the first thing you have to realize is that this technology is fundamentally different than anything we've used in the past. So if you used a Google search engine, for instance, in the past, and you did a query, you would hit one machine across the internet, right? One chip. You're asking for some information, and it delivers it to you. These chatbots are built in a different way. You're not grabbing a single piece of information. You're grabbing this system that has been trained on literally the entire internet. So you take all the text on the internet and you feed it into this system, and it spends months analyzing all that text and identifying patterns in all that text, and it learns the skills that you now see from a chatbot. But what that means is that all that information is analyzed by hundreds, thousands, now even more chips. That's the way it's built. And then when you have to deliver the system, you also have to query all this information via all sorts of chips. So each time you key something into ChatGPT, it's hitting all sorts of chips across these data centers.
And okay? So what does that mean for power? Is that why it's basically a power drain or a power suck?
That's exactly right. So rather than just hitting one chip, you're hitting thousands of chips, and that requires electrical power. Mm-hmm. So every time you type something into ChatGPT today, it's so expensive that these companies are losing lots of money. Even likely when you're paying for an advanced version of something like ChatGPT, those companies are probably taking a hit because it's so expensive because of the power.
Yeah.
Now, one way to think about this, and this ties into the environmental question, is that so much power is required that these things get far hotter than the machines of the past. So in the past, the systems on those long rows of computers I talked about within a data center, they would get hot. And basically what you would do is you would pump cool air beside these systems and you would cool it down. And as time went on, you would find ways of cooling them down through water. You could run the hot air beside a water pipe, basically, and cool it down. Now, these chips that are doing the AI work are getting so hot, they're using so much electrical power, that you have to run the water all the way to the system, mm-hmm. all the way to the rack, as they say. There are racks of computers. You run the water, the cool water, all the way there. And in some cases, I've seen this, all the way to the chip itself. So the chip itself is getting so hot, the water has to go all the way there. Mm-hmm. And many of these data centers are using far more water in that way. And that's why you might need water from the environment. There are newer systems that are what they call closed loop, where you keep the water in a closed loop and you don't use as much. But that's not always the way it works.
And you're talking about millions of gallons of water a day.
Yes. And that's what you need to realize is in the short term, these companies are racing forward so quickly. They're not necessarily taking the route that is best for the environment. They're not going with nuclear power or wind power or these closed loop water cooling systems. They're going for the system that is cheapest today and quickest.
Yeah. Which might mean dirtiest as well. Let's bring in a caller. This is Betty Ann from Wayne on line 3 has a question. I think about the built environment of these data centers, and I had some questions about that as well. So Betty Ann, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, my question is, you know, pretty simple. Obviously, these are going to be built, whether we, the residents close by or whatever, had any input into that. And I'm wondering if they do put solar on the roof, do they have green roofs? Can they plant trees all the way around these buildings to make them look better, but also to offer a minor mitigation to the environmental impact?
So Ben, can you comment on that? Because I would just add on to that, like, just generally, what's it like to live near these things? Are they loud? Are they, you know, spewing stuff into the air? Do they do anything to mitigate how bad they seemingly look, or just their local environmental impact? That's a lot there, but can you help us break it all down?
Right, and I'd say that many of these tech companies have spent a lot of time thinking about how to work on sustainability. I had spent 2 years consulting with Meta on some of these questions, exploring ways to improve the sustainability of their data centers. And for Meta and many other companies, Google and others, they're thinking heavily about renewable energy, so solar and wind, the extent to which batteries might play a role to even out the energy usage and the energy supply. And they're also thinking very deeply about the watersheds, right? Because when you're extracting water from the local environment for the cooling, you're going to have to worry about whether or not that's being replenished. I think the difficulty is that the data centers we were studying a few years ago were maybe 10 times smaller than the ones we're talking about today.
It's just changing so fast.
So we're now realizing that wind and solar alone aren't sufficient to get us to net zero, what they call net zero computing. In terms of mitigation, they are thinking about the wind and solar. They are thinking about managing the watershed. But the first and foremost is about where in the grid can you get the power that you need for the compute.
That's become a secondary concern. And so then the question then, Ben, is, you know, what does this mean for the decarbonization of our economy? Let me read a quote here. This is from a different Ben Cahill, quoted in the Washington Post in 2024. He's an energy market scholar at the University of Texas. This is his quote. The scenarios for rapid decarbonization of the power sector seem less viable today than they were just 6 months ago. We've been awash in all these projections about getting to, you know, carbon neutral by 2050. Are we just way off that track now?
For the tech industry, I think it's not clear whether or not we have the solutions to get to net zero compute. To put this into context, Google, for example, has made claims that they want to be net zero by 2030. That's clearly not going to happen, given how quickly they're building data centers. Their strategy for getting to net zero carbon for computing has been investing in wind, investing in solar, scheduling or deferring the compute to different times of day where there is more wind and more solar energy. And to some extent, it does help. But with generative AI, with these AI workloads, and with these GPUs, these power-intensive chips, that's not going to be enough. So it's not clear. It's pretty clear that we're not going to hit those goals that were set out just a few years ago.
Wow. Belinda writes on YouTube, companies should not be subsidized, should rather be forced by states to come only if they will build renewable energy sources only. So makes no sense to give tax abatements. Belinda's had a very strong sentiment there. We got a message from a listener, Mark in Delaware, who wrote, we need data centers, but they must be developed responsibly. And I wonder, like, you know, this is a leverage point, right? A lot of communities have these companies need the space. They need the grids. They need all these things. What does responsible development look like, Cade? And Ben, please add to this, to the extent that should there be questions that government officials are asking? Should there be requirements that they are putting down in order for these tax incentives? What should be happening here so that responsible building is happening, Cade?
Well, there are local communities that are pushing back. They're making themselves heard. On some level, the big tech companies are listening, but the incentives are just too great. And you know, Ben alluded going to that conference this summer where President Trump showed up. Right there's this larger you know, federal effort to feed this, and the larger geopolitical worry is that if it's not done here in the U.S., someone else will do it, particularly in China. That's the major rival in this AI race. So there's all this pressure. And frankly, there's just all this money and power behind these companies. You know, I saw this in Indiana, where you have locals pushing back. They're concerned, for instance, about this tiny wetland in the middle of this giant data center facility that Amazon is building, which is going to be plowed over, right? They're raising their concerns, but more often than not, these projects move forward because of the power and the money that are behind them.
It's the combination of computing power and political power and a financial power, and that's hard for local communities to overcome. I just want to get in one more caller. This is Jason from South Philly on line one, who has a question, I think, specifically about a Pennsylvania-based project. Jason from South Philly, what's your question, comment, or concern?
Hello, big fan. My name is Jason. I'm a local reporter here in Philadelphia, and I had written about and covered the building of Three Mile Island, the reopening of Three Mile Island specifically to power the Microsoft data centers. Why would they be willing to do this for Microsoft but not to bring down energy costs for Pennsylvanians?
That's a great question.
Thank you, Jason.
Benjamin, I know you had something to say about what Cade was talking about, but also Jason's question there. That's confusing to a lot of people because Three Mile Island's been sitting there for a long time, and nuclear power can supply a lot of energy. Then Microsoft comes along and all of a sudden we're refurbishing and reusing it.
It's interesting to talk about nuclear at this particular point in history. I think a couple of thoughts there. First, going back to the one about renewable energy, right? If we were trying to get carbon-free compute and we were relying entirely on solar and wind, we wouldn't get there. There's no way we could get there, right? So that requires expanding the solution space to include nuclear, partly because nuclear is carbon-free. It's got all sorts of other risks associated with waste, associated with operations and so on, but it is carbon-free, and it provides a lot of base load generation. So I think that's why there's this massive renewed interest in nuclear. And then when we talk about nuclear, there's new nuclear, and then there's older nuclear, right? So the new nuclear are the small modular reactors that Bill Gates and others are super excited about. Small modular reactors that can be built at scale, lower costs, etc. Those are unproven. We haven't shown that we can build those at scale. So now you've got old nuclear, like the one at Three Mile Island. And the question is, well, it's expensive to refurbish that nuclear plant, but Microsoft and others have the capital, have the money.
They're willing to spend the money.
They're willing to spend the money and do it. So I think that's a big aspect of it. But I think it's an opportunity for the nuclear industry, actually, because big tech has the resources they're willing to put into investing in that new nuclear.
Because that was one of the big hangups with nuclear, which was it's so expensive to build. Once it starts running, it can create a lot of clean energy. But now here's this investor who might be able to help you build that nuclear plant, or at least maybe a smaller one.
Yeah, and the difficulty with nuclear is that the United States has had a horrible track record of building these nuclear facilities on time and on budget.
Yeah.
And the reason they say that we don't have this is because you can't build just one. You have to build multiple of these. And getting that order book filled is going to be incredibly important.
It's a chain of problems, engineering problems, political problems, environmental problems that we all have to try to solve. But thank you for helping us today, Benjamin Lee, Professor of Electrical and Systems Engineering at the University of Pennsylvania, and Cade Metz, Technology Correspondent with the New York Times. Appreciate you both being here.
Yes. Thank you. And thank you to everybody who got through and called in. Well, I predict we'll be talking about this again and probably again and again. So much to talk about. Thanks so much to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, Al Banks, and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow.